This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. And with me, Kusu Chuang. And the morning run begins.
Yes, we do. We have.
It is a Tuesday. It's a Tuesday.
It's a saunter right now, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a gentle trot
before we get into high octane driven gear and race ahead.
God, such things.
We try our best. Okay, from the sublime to the silly, we of course have the world is such. China's GDP growth numbers were higher than expected. They were released yesterday, I believe, and you might be talking about it later, Chuang.
Yeah, nearly 7%. Quite amazing, right? At a time when the rest of the world isn't doing so great. So again, one has to ask, where does this growth come from?
Also, in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, authorities there are all in a tiz because a young woman had a video made of her walking about in a historic area of the country, a fort, I believe. She was walking around in a miniskirt and a crop top. Now, this has gotten the nation's authorities in a tiz.
What if he's got suddenly adopted a clipped British accent?
Because it has to be delivered as such, because there's no other way of delivering this news.
In a very prudent, genteel, gentlemanly way. There's only one way.
But not only are authorities very prickly in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, so are they in China. Winnie the Pooh, that much love a bear, because he's a character in a series of books.
Who does love his honey?
Who does love his pot of honey? He's been banned in China.
Why? For whatever reason.
Because bloggers and netizens in China have suggested that there is a resemblance between the country's supreme leader, Xi Jinping, and Winnie the Pooh.
You're joking, right?
No, I'm not joking.
No way.
And the Chinese authorities...
I thought these things happen only in Malaysia.
the Chinese authorities, in their infinite wisdom, are hunting down every image of Winnie the Pooh in order to stymie this attempt to... draw a likeness between Winnie the Pooh and Xi Jinping.
And so what if he resembles Winnie the Pooh? It's okay, he's a cuddly, likable bear. What's so wrong with that?
You think so, right? But yeah, see, this is what happens when people have power. They become extraordinarily fragile. they're egos. I mean, look, honestly,
is that why we've got such thick skins, Sharad? Because we've got no power at all?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to be.
Because
when you're small and you're trampled on a daily basis, you really have a thick
layer.
It's like a turtle or a tortoise. You have this carapace, this hard outer shell. Yeah, it's
and
important.
A soft and vulnerable inside.
Oh, I don't know. Chuang, from the sublime to the silly.
Facebook's banned in China, but everybody's got a Facebook account.
Because the Chinese are smart that way.
Ah.
Okay, next up we have Cher. Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that's Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves by Cher. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Kusu Chuang.
The Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves, well, not necessarily thieves, but Gypsies and Tramps of BFM.
I love Cher. Cher's from, she's been around for so long.
Yeah, she's...
And she's ageless.
She's swallowed the age-defying potion, hasn't she?
She has. And I want to get my hands on that little bottle. That little vial.
Once you swallowed it...
Was it the Fountain of Youth, is it?
The Fountain of Youth, yeah.
Okay. Mm. So, yesterday we had the launch of the full MRT line phase one, I believe. So it was phase two of the first line. Let's put it this way. So remember, phase one was just a couple of stations, and then phase two was the whole thing, taking commuters from Sungai Buloh all the way to Kajang. Now, during the launch, which was done with great fanfare, I wonder how much it costs the taxpayer. But nevertheless, the Prime Minister said that, I'm going to quote him, "I asked someone recently to rate our MRT. Where do we stand compared to others? The person said we are better than London, New York or Hong Kong and on par with Singapore." So
the first question that popped in my mind was, why have you been told rather than trying it yourself? Because if you have tried it yourself, then you would know, wouldn't you? Whether or not you drive the subway in New York, London or Malaysia, because you know, isn't it right for you to at least try it?
Where to try the...
The Prime Minister.
Yeah, he did try it. Yeah. The local line.
He said, I've been told.
Yeah, because, you know, then it would be a vain boast if he did it himself, right? So he was saying that in the opinion of others who also have experienced a variety of train systems, of metro systems, that this is... Well, what's interesting, you know, I was recently in India and Calcutta... had a MRT system, an underground system, like a century ago.
Really?
Yes, yes.
And you've
yes.
never tried it?
And, you know, I tried it. I got onto it. Yeah. I mean, and in Russia, I went to Russia many years ago and it was still part of the Soviet Union.
You lucky sod.
And yeah. Yeah, and you know, it has a massive underground system. So we're kind of a little late in the game in terms of trying to boast about you know, mass rapid metro systems
because we have a national car project, and therefore, you know, public
transport
has taken
a back seat. Yeah, but okay. So the question is, let's put that aside. The question for me, Chuang, this morning is, how do you rate a metro system? What is it that makes a good metro system for you?
Well, for me, the main thing is convenience. Like in London, I mean, that's my reference point.
Okay.
Excuse me. Look, I mean, in London, you can pretty much walk to any tube station, get on the train, and you can just get to anywhere, yeah? That's the main thing. I think Tokyo is the same thing. Hong Kong is the same thing. But in Malaysia, you can't exactly just rock up to the station and just take a ride to the next place because you've got to be either driven there or dropped off there or taken a feeder bus there. And that, for me, is the main thing. Because by itself, the system is amazing. I've tried it, right? The trains are amazing. The stations are clean. The people are efficient, and the machines are new, etc. But they're just not convenient. You can't just rock up to a station.
And I think for me, in extending that argument, I would say that a good system is one that encourages people, that in fact makes people want to keep their cars at home and switch. So, you know, switching behavior is really would be the real success story. It's not just what you see. It's not the breadth of the cars, all of which I think is in without dispute. I mean, it's very hard these days and at this day and age to get this wrong. You have enough examples, you know, internationally to draw from. If you haven't drawn from the best practices, then there's something wrong with us. But the question is, you know, in getting people to switch, you know, and also I've tried some of these stations, Chuang. The Bandar Utama station is really odd because if you want to go to Wan Utama, the shopping mall, you can't take the shortest route there.
Yeah.
It's this long and winding way to get there. And, you know, I don't understand it.
So the family and I, we tried it one Sunday. We actually had to drive to Pusat Bandar Damansara, which is our nearest station, park the car, get in the train. Fantastic train, by the way. Fantastic station, fantastic system, great ride, nice view. Then got to the station at Bandar Utama. Walked downstairs, it was raining that day, and literally were facing a 2 kilometer trudge through the rain in the streets to get to the mall. And I was wondering, where is the convenience in all this?
Yeah.
And then I was told that there is a feeder bus, but the feeder bus only comes at a certain time, hourly intervals. Otherwise, you take the private sector one, which costs you $7 per person or something. And I was wondering, what is going on? Why would you want to do this?
So I think the question of planning, you know, where the stations are and how they connect with the environment around it is crucial. We've had this problem with other systems as well, the LRT. They're just, you know... tourist spots not being connected, say, for instance, to stations. It just isn't that thoughtfulness when it comes to connectivity, or the costs are prohibitive, or, you know, it's just not possible. And I'm not quite sure because of where the stations are located. So some stations are located by highways. You can't walk to them. And when you compare, say, the London Underground and
correct.
The way in which it seems like stations are in neighborhoods. I mean, they just seem
correct.
To be there, kind of.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's always they don't stand out. They're just part of the landscape.
Yeah, your little
here,
tiny
every
little
station is like a huge, massive edifice, like cathedral to something or other.
Correct. I remember there was one time we went to the Abbey Road Studios where the Beatles recorded some of the albums.
You had to throw that in.
Okay. Yeah, for sure, right? Yeah. And then, you know, there's a little tiny little station there which could have passed for like a newsagent. And you walk down and you've got this labyrinth available to you. It's fantastic. I think we've been crippled because we've come to the MRT thing so late in our city's development that we've been crippled by the amount of development that's happened around the city. But back then, when the London Tube was built, the city was a different incarnation then.
Well, we'll be back with more after these messages. ZZ Top, give me all your loving. Maybe MRT might say, give us some more loving, lah, you know? Why are we so critical? Anyway, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Kusu Chuang, myself, Sharad Kutin. Now, recently, a minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Dato Sri Weeka Siong, officiated a JV event between local construction firm ML Global and China's Sany Group, involved in precast concrete. This brings ML Global into adopting what they call an IBS construction system online. Now, the minister in the in the Prime Minister's Department was asked many questions, and he weighed in on the question of manpower in the construction industry. Very interesting what he had to say.
A lot of people give you the crazy suggestion. Besides Indonesia, you can get any foreign workers. You have to see the Indonesian workers. They can stand the hot weather. You get anyone from Sabah, Sarawak, you assume that they can work like Indonesian workers, you are wrong. They probably spend one day, the next day they run away. Other nationals, they are not as durable as the Indonesian. They really can tahan lasak. This is the reality that we are facing.
Okay, so that was...
There's only one reaction to that statement.
Hold on. Just tell people who that was. They missed it. It was Dato Sri Weeka Siong, Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. Okay, now I know, at least with you, it's raised some giggles. With some people, it raised some heckles.
Well,
they'll be reading him in all kinds of ways. Again, the context in which he made the statement was an event around construction and the adoption of what they call IBS construction systems, right?
Okay, so the context is this. ML Global is the construction arm of LBS Bina, the developer that does medium-priced homes, yeah? And that's the sector they're going into. Now, in construction, the main issue, the main challenge in that sector is the lack of workers or the worker availability because of our immigration policy. So with IBS, which is Intelligent Building Systems, the demand for foreign workers is vastly reduced because they're modular, they're easy to construct, and they take a lot shorter time. So the demand for foreign workers is not really there. But what I really impressed me, without wanting to be too negative, is the fact that those words came from a cabinet minister, not from some pedestrian off KLCC's sidewalk, but... Someone who's in charge of the sector.
So he's just saying the way to move forward is, in fact, to get into, you know, prefabricating, you know, construction systems.
But
did
he have to have a side swipe? Which,
but you see, it's
a la Conor McGregor's job.
This is the issue, right? So what is he? So was he praising the Indonesian workers while making them sound like pack animals, you know, mules or whatever? Or was he insulting Sabahans and Sarawakians?
I think both.
Because what he'd suggest about the Sabahans and Sarawakians as an example, right? Because I think he was reaching for if people say replace the Indonesians, who would they be? He's saying, well, you know, actually, like all Malaysians, they perhaps don't want to do the 3D jobs, the dirty, dangerous, and I know it's not demeaning, but it's one of those jobs. I wasn't sure. I mean, it did seem, depending on how you wanted to be offended, you could be offended at so many things that he said.
I don't know what to say. It's just the fact that it comes from this cabinet. You know, there's a chess move where if you move your piece in a particular way, you can attack two pieces at the same time. So if you put your horse in the position, you can attack the queen as well as the castle, right? Yeah. And I think with politicians in this country, sometimes, and I'm, you know, perhaps someone...
Your horse, you mean the knight?
Your knight. Your knight, yeah. Some of these political statements are intended that way because they're meant to do this as well as that. And they're very politically charged
well,
in that respect.
Well, I must say, when I first heard the clip, I thought, well, that's curious. But you know, remember Amir Mohammed's a series of books?
Very good writer, by the way. One of Malaysia's best.
Yeah, he had a series of books called Politicians Say the Darndest Things, right? And it's a collection of these faux pas and, you know, foot-in-mouth moments of Malaysian politicians. Literally, he's had, I think, a series of maybe three or four books.
Yeah.
You know,
every single day.
somebody produces something worthy of quoting for posterity.
I've been a journalist 20 years, and I used to cover some of these press conferences. And one time, I don't want to name the minister, but it was about counterfeiting. It was about intellectual property infringement. It was about illegal CDs. And we went to the press conference, and the minister in question, I'm not going to say the science name, He started going off ad infinitum about Mariah Carey, and he didn't just
Mariah Carey, the singer.
Yeah, it wasn't about. He started off, and he didn't pronounce it Mariah Carey. He went Mariah Carey or something like that. And all of us in the press call were like, wondering what the in heaven's name is he going on about? And he went on for like 7 minutes about Mariah Carey and about how she sings amazing songs. And then the last statement was about nobody should take her songs away from her. And we're like, what is going on?
And how was that related to the topic of the day?
Because at the time she was the top artiste and all the CDs were off, you know.
I sometimes think about it because, look,
Amir Mohammed's book would have included at least some of those because she's like, why?
I think the thing about politicians making strange remarks, and this is nothing unique to Malaysia, okay? It's global to some extent, is the pressure on politicians to continually speak, to weigh in on a range of things, half of which they might not be competent
without having
at.
Any knowledge whatsoever.
Yeah, and so, you know, because the
but
media...
But
that's
a bit like radio presenters. You ask to talk.
Absolutely. We're going
to say, we have to say something.
Thankfully, we're not elected, so nobody's going to blame us. But the truth of the matter is the media is also responsible, constantly going to politicians and demanding sort of soundbite.
Yeah.
And you know, and these poor fellas who are paid from the public purse feel compelled to say something and fill in the air. So I think, Chuang, if we were in China today, we would both be hauled off to jail, I think. Because in China, you cannot, and I'm come back to winning
so
the pool.
So, glass half full, there is democracy in Malaysia. We are allowed to say what
absolutely.
We say.
Absolutely. Okay, this is Deep Blue Something with Breakfast at Tiffany's, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Kusu Chuang and myself, Sherrod Kutin.
Rocking the Casbah in the studio.
Yes, 39 minutes past 6. And it is the 18th of July. And there are only three letters in the English alphabet of any worth note today.
M, F and B.
No, G-O-T. Game of Thrones.
No.
The seventh season of Game of Thrones kicked off yesterday. Episode one is titled Dragonstone. And of course, it premiered at about 10 o'clock for viewers in the US.
What is this preoccupation you guys have with Game of Thrones? I don't watch it, so what's the big deal?
Well, it's like Star Wars or any of these other, you know, kind of products of popular culture. They grip the imagination. They catapult individual stars and actors in these shows to superstardom. They get legions of fans.
So, why is it so interesting?
And gazillions of dollars are dropped in all kinds of ways, right? There's an economy on one side to produce these television series, high production values, great costuming. Yesterday I watched Bloomberg show on, or was it a BBC show, on how much of the costumes were made in India. So there are particularly craftsmen who create these extraordinarily exquisite costumes for the show.
But why do you watch it? What's the big deal? What's the attraction?
Well, I mean, personally, the attraction is that the movies really, and the story by George R.R. Martin really kind of captures the human condition. I mean, the creation of societies, the creation of nation states, the nature of politics, sibling rivalry,
greed, fear,
and all those major things. Yeah, it's Shakespearean in its ambitions.
I'm so far behind the curve; it's not even funny. So there's 7 seasons now. Yeah,
seven. Gosh, so this is a season number 7. You know, it's kind of.
Can I jump in at season 7 and start watching?
Well, I think. Yeah, chances are you can. I mean, these things are created in such a way, right? But to know the backstory, because there've been a huge number of characters that have come onto the stage,
and they come and go,
and they come and go, and you know your favorite ones. You live in trepidation that your favorite character is going to have his head chopped or
because they tend to just get killed off.
They don't stick around. They're unsentimental. So the stories are unsentimental. They don't kind of keep much loved figures. Okay, well,
it's a bit like BFM radio presenters. We just appear and then we just disappear.
And then some of us might be a Jon Snow. So a Jon Snow, he's one of the most enduring of the characters in the cast, and perhaps in ways that you might think, they've dropped the ball on the unsentimentality. Jon Snow is one of the children of the kind of central family in a story of many competing feudal-like families, right, of royals who control particular territories in this mythical land. And so you have Daenerys Targaryen, the Queen of Dragons. She actually does have dragons. So you have a sense of where this world is. It's not created in the future. It kind of created in the mythological past. And so there is all that. And then there are all these, you know, different negotiations. So it's not, I'm not a big fantasy genre fan myself, Chuang, but I did get into it partly because the sheer brutality and it was so raw in terms of the emotions and the depiction of things that I just thought, my goodness, it feels real.
I got to watch myself one of those episodes because just the way you're getting into it. You're so invested in the storyline.
Yeah, I mean, do you ever get into this?
The last time I did was Breaking Bad, but then again, I'm so far behind. I was so far behind the curve on that one. It wasn't even funny then. It's not even less funny
now.
Yeah,
I kind of fell out after a while. You see, unlike the great television series of the present era, and I think of The Wire, that American series.
I haven't even watched that.
Oh, that is brilliant. I mean, I think if you're a journalist, you'd want to get
Newsroom, I like quite a lot, actually.
Yeah, I didn't quite get into that. But, you know, I watched the first 2 episodes. But I think the problem with Breaking Bad is that it's very much kind of like centered on the characters. You must really love them because there's no social and political import. There's no mise-en-scène. There's this that of value.
But then you don't have to watch it. You just, you know, get lost in the subtext and off you go. This one weekend just disappears.
Yeah,
just like that.
I know. I mean, but you remember that episode where they were chasing a fly in the factory they were creating? Yes.
I thought that was hilarious.
After that episode, I stopped watching Breaking Bad. For me, that was indulgent and superficial. You know,
that's because you're far too intelligent for those kind
no,
of series,
I don't
right?
think so. I watch Game of Thrones. If you want to see don't have to be intelligent to watch Game of Thrones.
Shameless promotion. If you want to watch how intelligent Sharad can be at 6:44 in the morning, go and check out my Instagram. There's lots of examples of Sharad being intelligent there.
I think it's set to private, isn't it?
No. Your dancing is public.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you got me there. Okay, this is, if you haven't already heard it, if it doesn't make your give you goosebumps and make you tingle, this is the Game of Thrones theme song, BFM BFM 89.9, Kusus Chuang and myself, Sharad Kutin, and we continue our prattling, if you might call it that. Some people might be really upset that we went decidedly popular culture there with
GOT.
With the GOT. Mm. The Orang Asli, it's a collective name for a range of communities on the peninsula that we associate with an older way of living.
East Malaysia, no?
No. So the East Malaysians are Orang Asal, if you want to use that term. The Orang Asli refers specifically to the peoples of the peninsula. Now, according to anthropologist Alberto Gomez of La Trobe University in Australia, the Orang Asli community here are looked down upon. They kind of stigmatized and considered, and I put this in air quotes, primitive by the mainstream population. He's called on the education ministry to expose urban children to the lifestyles of the Orang Asli community, to get us to understand better, their culture, to erase these misconceptions. We spoke to Kamal Sohaimi Fazil. He's the lecturer of anthropology and sociology at the University of Malaya, and asked him about the consequences of not understanding Orang Asli culture.
Okay, so by not incorporating formal stories about Orang Asli and their cultures in our formal education, we continue to perpetuate the misconceptions that we have about the Orang Asli. We paint a picture of the Orang Asli in a negative way. The stereotypes include us thinking that Orang Asli has no conception of land, that Orang Asli are not civilized, that Orang Asli have no religion, that Orang Asli have not contributed at all to nation building, or that Orang Aslis are anti-development.
So that's Kamal Sohaimi Fazil. Now we're asking for the flip side, which is how the Orang Asli community and the individuals who make up this, I think it's about 200,000 strong community, how they're affected by these negative stereotypes.
Okay, so I mean, the most obvious is that it's the way other people treat them, is the way we interact with them when we engage with Orang Asli community. We tend to look down on them. We tend to take their rights and their needs and their issues for granted. For example, it could be if government draws up a policy or program for Orang Asli, if this misconception colors their decision, it affects the way they plan. It affects the way they implement. So for the everyday person, when we go to areas that are designated as ecotourism sites, and we go to places where there are Orang Asli villages in these ecotourism areas, we tend to assume we can just walk into a village without asking for permission from the local people, taking photographs without asking for permission, and paying them whatever we think is their value rather than asking them what is the value of their service or what is the value of whatever we want from them, you know. This we do not do with our neighbors here in town. We do not do with other communities who are not Orang Asli. We wouldn't walk into a Chinese village or an Indian village or a Malay village and assume we can just go into somebody's house or look into their house and take photos or walk into their garden, right? We wouldn't do that, right?
That was Kamal Sohaimi Fazil, lecturer of anthropology from University of Malaya.
How far right is he and how far wrong we are about our conceptions about the Orang Asli? And I want to point out as well, I mean, this is my point of view. If we had more Orang Asli people with their beliefs in government, in the world, maybe we might not have so much climate change, because to them, it's unfathomable that people can actually own land and have titles over land, because in that community, there is no such thing as ownership of land. There is no such thing as killing animals for game. And certainly among the Orang Aslis, there is no such thing as cancer, stroke, high blood pressure, all these disorders, because they're not at the grindstone.
Well, but it's true. They might not suffer from some of the, I mean, because they're like every other human being, they also have problems.
The challenges,
their health and stuff. But you're absolutely right. I just think that, and I wonder, because they are such a small community, and like so many other small minority cultures in the country, people might not have encountered an Orang Asli individual. I mean, it might be as bad as that, not encountered them in their, where they might be, still have tribes, because there are a lot of people who have incorporated. We have an Orang Asli senator. We've had an Orang Asli senator since independence.
Yeah.
And every session, the Senate always has an Orang Asli senator as representative. But the more and more I think the Orang Asli community has articulated its needs, and has pushed back against things that have deprived them of their rights, they become more and more visible.
Well, it's a global challenge. Remember, I mean, on BFM we play the song called "Beds Are Burning" by Midnight Oil. Midnight Oil, actually the lead singer is half Aboriginal, and "Beds Are Burning," actually he's talking about the beds in his homeland, in the country, in the outback, being burnt by settlers and developers. And I think that's the political subtext.
Right, so you're talking about...
Peter Garrett, I think. Yeah, and eventually he became a minister in the Australian government.
Right. So you're talking about the question of indigenous people, global
indigenous people,
right?
Correct. But that's what Orang Asli are, because when you translate it, it's basically native people.
Yeah. And I think it's also associated, because indigeneity here makes reference to all kinds of people, including the Malay community. Everybody is in some ways Bumiputra or indigenous, right? Because that's what Bumiputra suggests. But I think here indigeneity is got to do with your relationship to the land, economy. You're not
a
peasant.
That's right.
You're not an urban dweller and a member of the working class. You're somebody whose economy and life and culture is associated with...
And we are so far wrong to view them in that prism, because they've gotten so many things right, and they've been around for a lot longer than we have in some respects, that we've got to educate ourselves. And I believe the professor's, what he says, is correct.
And both of them, there was Kamal Suhaimi Fazil with University of Malaya. We'll be back after this, a Green Day, when I come around, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Kusu Chuang. I'm Sharad Kutin.
Yes, okay. Good morning, Mr. Kutin.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for it. It's coming up to 7 minutes past seven on this beautiful July 18th morning. Actually, it's still a bit dark and grim out there. Advisor to the human rights organization SWAM has urged Malaysians to set their priorities straight over issues concerning the country, saying that big issues have gone unnoticed. And this is Dr. Kwa Kia Sung. He's an academic, a sociologist, I believe. He says it's ironic that there's been more noise over public caning in Kelantan than there's been about the hanging of a Malaysian in Singapore. We asked Jahab Asadik, because he's the editor of the Malaysian Insight, we asked him if he agrees with the sentiment that we are investing a disproportionate amount of energy on less pertinent issues of the day.
Okay, so I think if you look at social media, most people on social media comment on issues which seem trivial to a lot of others, like Pakatan leadership, for example, or the fact that the logo looks like something out of Star Trek. But that's because this is a social media that you follow, right? Because social media works on you have to follow them, particularly ordinary citizens. They don't pay money to promote their views, right? But generally, people who have too busy or focused on the issues have no time to vent their frustration on social media. As we talk about, people are affected by living costs rising, for example, or real politics of trying to correct what they think where the country is going wrong, for example, right? So I can't agree with Mr. Kwa Kia Sung, because I think there are many issues people are concerned about. It's just that they don't talk about it. And if they do talk about it, they don't talk about it on social media. Quite a number of people in Malaysia actually think social media is just for kids. It's just for people who have very juvenile ways of thinking. So I don't think it's fair to say that we spend a lot of time focused on civil issues.
That's Jabba Sadeka, editor of Malaysian Insight. We're going to carry on with him. He also was asked about his opinion about what should we focus our attentions on.
I think the main issues of what's leading up to election is already out there. Issues like the 1MDB scandal, race and religion, for example. Human rights, LGBT rights, and all take a back seat for the simple reason people are thinking of their stomachs first and their future rather than issues which they think only affect a smaller part of our society and community. So to them, there are not that many people who are pro-LGBT or who are members of the community. They are blinkered to think, hey, this is not a big issue for me. I've got bigger issues to handle. I don't have enough money for myself. I don't have enough money to buy a house. I don't have money for my kids. I don't have enough money to get married, for example. So it's all a question of priority for most people. I mean, we're still a developing country. We're not a developed country where there's social welfare, where people who can ponder about issues that affect society. We're still we're a community-based society where we are thinking more what's the collective good for the community at large and individually our lives. Right, you have to remember, we're just one generation from people who mainly stayed in the rural areas and who are now either in cities or in areas which were once rural and now considered urban. Thanks to social media, thanks to handphone and all that, right? So, so I think the revolution in changing your mindset takes more than one generation, for Malaysia at least.
That was Jabar Sadiq, editor of Malaysian Insider, because formerly the Malaysian Insider. Chong, I want to come back to Dr. Kwa Kia Soong's initial assertion and that example that was given, that we're making more noise about public caning in Kelantan than the hanging of a Malaysian in Singapore. Is that a good example, do you think, of skewed priorities?
Well, I agree with Jabar, because the things that affect you most are the ones that you think about the most. And the fact that it's...
And they're very personal,
correct.
Private issues.
Yeah, exactly. Livelihoods, food on the table. Those are the main things affecting all Malaysians. I'm presuming the Malaysian that was killed in... Well, you know, that died in Singapore was as a result of drug-related offences, yeah? This legislation has existed for decades. And I'm afraid, you know, if you fall foul of drug trafficking laws, then you're going to pay the consequences. I would... asserts humbly that perhaps a public caning in Kelantan is more applicable to all Malaysians, because unless you're a drug trafficker, you've got nothing to be concerned about. But the question of whether Sharia or non-Sharia law applies to you is, potentially more pertinent to you. But even more pertinent to the individual is really food on the table, your livelihoods, the economy, and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, so in terms of where public opinion lies and what you should be really concerned about, it's really what affects you.
Okay.
And he's right. The Jabba's right. We are one generation away. We are one generation away.
Okay, so what affects you is, so what affects you is in just what is in your immediate environment,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
So it could be long term, right?
Absolutely.
So the changing nature of the law and governance in this country also affects you. It might seem a little abstract, but it affects you.
It's what potentially.
Bread and butter issues are the ones that are more direct. But I do want to come back to very quickly to that question of the Malaysian who was executed in Singapore. We actually interviewed the representative for Amnesty International the day before his execution. There was an appeal to stay that execution. It wasn't allowed. In that instance, because the laws in Singapore are written in such a way that they presume guilt, not innocence, the question of the rule of law and the undermining of the rule of law is important in that case. Also, there were extenuating circumstances, all of which the courts, because the mandatory sentencing is not allowed, it also was raised concerns of human rights activists. So I think somebody like Dr. Kwa would be very cognizant of the long-term implications of having legislation that one presumes guilt, not innocence, and then puts the burden of proving that you're innocent on the person accused for future, you know, rule of law issues. And so I think,
I agree.
It's not an either, for me, it's not an either or situation.
Well, correct. And it's a narrow view, I guess, of what affects you as an individual. I get it. I mean, I studied law back in the day, and I get it. I get the fact that, you know, these are very rigorous circumstances that Singapore imposes on people that decide to come into its borders. I get it. But in terms of what people should believe in or have interest in, absolutely.
It's interesting that we interviewed Jabar Sadiq, because he's an editor of a portal that is in some ways determining what we think on a daily basis about our world.
Well,
right?
You don't have to visit the Malaysian Insider.
You don't
visit
have
any
to.
Number
but,
of web
but
news
to the
websites.
Extent that the media is involved in setting the news agenda, setting the agenda of what is important.
Well, the fact that you and I, Sharad, are up at 7:13 in the morning talking about things, we are setting the agenda, because unless you tune into Hits FM, you're not going to get your daily deals of getting ready for the business day ahead. And we are, in a way, agenda setters, like it or not.
But do you think that in many ways the Malaysian media and people like ourselves don't get it right? Our personal
obsession...
We get
it wrong all the time.
Do we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for example, someone who is living in less privileged circumstances might not care about the death sentence in Singapore, because he just cares about getting through the day and getting some food on the table for his or her kids.
But
and it's as simple as that.
But what about people, you know, I mean, but can we live in a society, especially a democratic one, where people opt out of those, the difficult questions of the day? I mean, I know we understand why they do opt out, but can a democratic society be predicated on, you know, a good part of the population not being concerned about these issues?
Yeah, a lot of people have their heads buried in the sand. That's why, and sometimes maybe that leads to a more blissful life, because the less you know, on my WhatsApp profile, I've got this saying, okay, life has become immeasurably better since I stopped taking it seriously. And that quote came from Hunter S. Thompson, one of the, you know, the gonzo journalists who actually committed assisted suicide. So,
so clearly,
so he opted out, but in the most extreme of circumstances.
Well, you know, I do think that, you know, and we've had this on the grill as well. We talked to the one of the advocates of universal basic income, and the argument there is that when you provide people with this kind of social safety net, in fact, they've become less tense, more likely to be generous, more likely to be open and, you know, and embrace democracy and inclusiveness rather than being open to much more fascistic, exclusivist and, you know, popular notions of how to run the world. So that's an ongoing conversation about how do we alleviate the problems of the working man and woman in the street. So we'll be back with more after this, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.